I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up just in time for Women's History Month, the Lady Huskies of the University of Connecticut set a new NCAA record last night of most consecutive victories, bringing their total to 71. We'll have a breakdown of this milestone in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about what could be a pivotal moment in education and civil rights. Obama administration Education Secretary Arne Duncan announced that his department will be stepping up enforcement of civil rights violations in the nation's schools. The department intends to launch 38 investigations across 30 states to verify that students of all races are getting equal opportunity to coursework that prepares them for higher education. In a moment, we'll hear from a man who some consider an unlikely critic of one approach to achieving that opportunity. He's a New York State senator who represents Harlem, where many parents are eager supporters of charter schools. And now he's saying, not so fast. And we will hear from Wade Henderson, who's the president of the Leadership Conference Education Fund. But first, we're going to hear from NPR education correspondent Claudio Sanchez, who's going to tell us more about what these civil rights investigations are all about. Welcome, Claudio. Welcome back, I should say.
Always good to be here.
I just want to read you a short clip from Secretary Duncan's speech yesterday. And he said that in recent years, civil rights enforcement was sometimes portrayed as dealing only with outright bigotry and a narrowly defined set of explicitly discriminatory practices, even as it overlooked patterns of pervasive inequalities. The truth is that in the last decade, the Office of Civil Rights Enforcement has not been as vigilant as it should have been in combating gender and racial discrimination. What is he talking about?
Well, first of all, for the record, the administration's or the 38 investigations or so-called compliance reviews that the administration is launching are neither much bigger or more numerous than they were in previous year, not last year or the year before. But what Rosalyn Ali over at the Division of Civil Rights at the Department has said is that its investigations are going to be far more deeper, certainly more extensive, because certainly the administration feels that these problems have been ignored. And what we're talking about here, of the 6,300 complaints, civil rights complaints that the department gets every year, most of them include sexual violation as early as middle school, sexual harassment, the disproportionate suspension and disciplining of black children, the poor treatment of non-English speaking students, and denial of special services, including access to college preparatory courses and advanced placement programs. The list goes on and on. Of course, the list of schools that are going to be targeted for these compliance reviews and some of the guidance that is going to go out, many of these districts still don't know who they are. And one reason, in my view, is that the administration is trying to choreograph a lot of this so that it doesn't look like it's being heavy-handed. It is trying to make a very clear point, and the way Rosalyn Ali put it was the department's Division of Civil Rights is back, and it's going to do a far more aggressive job.
Speaking of choreographing, the announcement was made at a civil rights landmark. I don't know any other way to put it, one of the sort of the critical places in the civil rights history of this country in Selma, Alabama, on the 45th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, where hundreds of civil rights protesters were beaten by state troopers in an effort to get voting rights. Now, what was the significance of holding the announcement
there?
Well,
the symbolism, as Secretary Duncan, I believe, mentioned in his speech, is that he wanted to say, look, we have come a long way. We have made enormous gains and improvements in the treatment and education of minority children, especially black children. But clearly, there is so much more to do, and that is really the impetus of this announcement.
And Wade Henderson, I'm going to bring you in. Claudia, I'd like you to stand by and chime in from time to time if you feel you can add to the conversation. Wade, you'd expect that the department would be involved in explicit, objectionable treatment of students, but it sounds as though they're taking it further than that and talking about access to certain types of courses and things of that sort. What is your take on that? Do you think that that's an appropriate use of the department's resources? Is that the appropriate direction?
I think it's absolutely appropriate, Michelle. First of all, oversight is always important as a guarantor of the enforcement of civil rights laws. And I think the announcement yesterday, as symbolically important as it was, should not be seen in adversarial terms. I mean, the compliance that the Department of Education is seeking is required by law. And when you go to campuses and discover, first of all, that over half of African American and Latino kids don't graduate from high school on time. Approximately 12% of high schools in our country, about 2,000 schools in total, are known as dropout factories because they are responsible for about 75% of African-American and Latino dropouts from schools. So, I mean, those kinds of statistics are a glaring indicator that something is wrong in the system. And I think what the secretary has recognized is that, as we've always known, education is the universally recognized guarantor of equal opportunity in American life, and he's trying to ensure
that. Well, there were those who would wonder, though, is this a civil rights issue or an issue of teacher competence or some other factor? And I'm just asking you to sort of articulate why it is that you and clearly the administration feels that this is a civil rights issue.
Well, education, first of all, is a clear civil and human right. And why we think it's a civil right is because without a competent education, you can't possibly be effective in American society in the 21st century. And the fact is that states are required by law when they provide education to do it in an equal manner. But there are too many indicators that disparities that exist are the result of a combination of factors, both current and historic, that deprive African American and Latino kids, particularly in poor communities, of the opportunities they deserve. Some of it has to do with the nature of the facilities that they are using, which are old and outdated. Some has to do with the assignment of teachers. Some of the most inexperienced and ill-prepared are assigned to the most challenging communities. But a lot of it has to do with resources and the way in which schools are funded, and it also has to do with the failure of colleges to accept and comply with existing civil rights doctrine.
Claudia?
Michelle, if I may just jump in. I think that folks certainly on the administration side have made the point that it's the achievement gap that is now paramount, not so much the racial mixing of schools. And the way that, again, Ruslan Ali at the Division of Civil Rights at the Department has said is that the achievement gap is a product of the opportunity gap in this country. And that gets back to the question you asked, which is, what is it that Latino and Black kids in particular are missing out on? And that is good teachers, a sensible, a rigorous curricula, certainly opportunities to get into that college track, because so many Black and Latino kids are often tracked into non-college programs. And so it is really this access to quality education as defined by educators that this administration is concerned about and that they feel is really at the crux of this whole effort.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with NPR correspondent Claudio Sanchez, who covers education, and civil rights activist Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. And we're talking about the Obama administration's new push to address civil rights issues or inequities in the nation's schools. And now I want to turn to New York State Senator Bill Perkins. Senator Perkins, one way that the administration is trying to address traditional inequities in education is by aggressively pushing charter schools and other educational experiments. And you initially were a supporter of charter schools as a way to provide more opportunities, particularly with students in your area. You represent Harlem. But now you've become more skeptical. Why?
Well, I've learned it's the wrong way. I've learned that, in fact, charter schools may even aggravate our efforts to live up to those civil rights visions that were exemplified during 1965 in Selma, Alabama. And it's, I guess, best represented by the statement of the mayor of the city of New York, who says charter schools are prep schools for children of color. Now, this is supposed to be a public school system in which the leader of the city is advocating for separate and what I believe are unequal educational opportunities by suggesting that the best way to teach our children is to teach them in terms of charter schools, privatized approaches towards public education.
But these are public schools.
They are using public dollars, but nevertheless, these schools only exist in communities of color. There are no charter schools in New York City that are in those communities that are not of color. In other words, the mayor has designed a system in which he expresses that this is where the charter schools will exist. And in fact, in my district, we have been saturated by charter schools. And my district of Harlem is like the Harlems of the city, in which such saturation has been taking place.
But can I just ask you, what's wrong with the point of that
school system?
Well, what if parents want, but the parents aren't being compelled to send their children to these schools. If they are seeking out these schools for their children, what's wrong with that? And what's wrong with prep schools for students of color? If I can just address that phrase on its face.
Quote prep schools.
Quote prep schools. Okay.
Prep schools, by suggestion, are schools that have excellent outcomes, and that is not, in fact, the case with respect to the so-called charter schools that are in my district and throughout the city. These are schools that parents have chosen to attend, and I myself founded one of the first one in the state of New York. However, the results do not measure up to the hype. These schools are not competitively providing the kind of educational outcomes that, quote, any prep school, and in fact, even the schools that are regular public schools in other parts of the city, and particularly those districts, those neighborhoods that are for the most part white, they're not measuring up.
And we need to
so
take a short break.
We still have a two-tiered system of educational opportunity in New York City, one for children of color and one for others, and clearly the one for children of color are not measuring up competitively. The so-called charter school.
Senator, we need to take a short break. We will come right back to you after the break. But before we go, I just wanted to ask Wade Henderson if he had a brief comment on this. Does the leadership conference per se have an opinion about charter schools and whether they advance or detract from equal opportunity?
Yes, we do. I mean, I think we believe that charter schools have an important role to play in education reform. I mean, they provide options for students where obviously public schools have not met the demand for quality education that students require. But I do agree with Senator Perkins about the need for oversight. I think charter schools are often characterized in a romantic way to suggest that simply because enthusiastic students and principals come together, that that guarantees educational quality, and it does not. And I think an evaluation of charter schools suggests in some instances that that is overplayed.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about civil rights issues in education. We'll return with our roundtable with Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference Education Fund, New York State Senator Bill Perkins. He founded a charter school and has now become a critic of that approach to achieving educational opportunity, and NPR's education correspondent, Claudio Sanchez. Please stay with us, because that's all coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to continue our focus on education. In a few minutes, we'll have an update on that famous teacher that you have heard so much about, Jaime Escalante. He turned a group of underachieving students into whizzes at math. The story is the basis of the 1988 film Stand and Deliver, and we'll visit with a reporter who's just checked in with him. But first, we're going to continue this conversation about the multiple civil rights investigations being launched by the Department of Education. Here to talk more about this are NPR education correspondent Claudio Sanchez, New York State Senator Bill Perkins, and Wade Henderson, who's the president of the Leadership Conference Education Fund. That's an organization that promotes civil and human rights. Before we took our break, State Senator Bill Perkins was telling us that you were you founded one of the first charter schools in New York. You went to Collegiate in New York, which is a prep school. And so you've now become skeptical of charter schools as an approach to achieving educational equity for students who have traditionally not been well served by traditional public schools. If you just recap briefly why you have become a skeptic.
Essentially, they have not measured up, number one. And number two, they are being promoted in what I believe is a separate and unequal educational policy by the mayor of the city of New York. But let me just say that they are failing to live up to their promise.
Can I ask you, though, Senator Perkins, the parents in your district want this option. And as you noted, these are being paid for with tax dollars. Don't the parents have some right to a say in this?
Oh, yes, they do. And they are actually exercising that right by choosing. I am, as their elected official, sharing with them my observations of what is actually taking place. Our parents, unfortunately, are desperate about the failure of public education and are seeking relief anywhere that they can. And they are being, I believe, led to believe that the charter school experience is all that's left. And unfortunately, the numbers show that these schools are not measured. measuring up in any.
Let me ask Claudia. Let me bring Claudia Sanchez, NPR's education correspondent, into this conversation. Claudia, what does the data show? I know there have been studies.
There have been
many studies about this.
Many studies. The record is mixed. I'm sorry to say that there is really no clear data. For every study that has said that charter schools have done extraordinary things and that kids in these schools have flourished, there is another study that says that they haven't, that they are at best mediocre, and that they really have not surpassed regular public schools.
My understanding that the data shows different things for different grade levels.
It does.
Wade, you seem that you're shaking your head on that. Is that
no?
Does,
I think
does
you're
your
absolutely
that
right.
Comport with mine.
I think you're absolutely okay. Right. Some of the studies, as Claudio says, are mixed, but you are correct in suggesting that some of the data suggests that in the early years, performance does improve and it's measurable in many schools.
And I just want to point out one other piece of information we reported on this program, that UCLA professor Gary Orfield recently spearheaded a study that found that charter schools are, on average, more segregated than traditional public schools. But again, I think there are others who say that being sort of ethnically a sort of a mono-ethnic experience isn't not necessarily the issue for parents. The issue for parents is, are they getting a high-quality education which their children want? So just throwing that piece of information out there, and if people want to look up the conversation I had with Gary Orfield, we'll have a link on our website. So Wade Henderson, just weighing both things in the balance, weighing this sort of civil rights or new look at civil rights enforcement and this aggressive push for charter schools despite this mixed data, is the administration on the right track or the wrong track?
I think the administration is very much on the right track. I think it's using the tools that are available to it to affect policy at the state and local level, and they're also doing it in colleges. Public education is by and large a state function, and the federal government provides only about 7% of the dollars that are used in public education, so its role is relatively limited. Having said that, it's using its dollars effectively and creatively, and most importantly, they've announced yesterday that they will engage in an effective oversight of the enforcement of civil rights laws.
Bill Perkins, I'm going to ask you.
Well, let me just point out that the only national evaluation of charter schools was carried out by Stanford economist Margaret Raymond, and this was funded by pro-charter foundations. They found that compared to regular public schools, only 17% of charters got higher test scores. 46% had gains that were no different, and 37% was significantly worse. Clearly, we should move forward with what the Secretary Arne Duncan wants to do, but he needs to focus on that part of the public school system that is going under the radar when it comes to segregation.
Claudia, I'm going to give you the final word. I'm not going to ask you to assess whether the administration is on the right track or not. I don't think that's how your job, but I do want to ask you to what we should be looking forward next in terms of evaluating these questions. What are some of the next steps?
The Secretary will announce the first, if not the biggest, investigation in a large urban school systems. We've been told to hold on to what that system is going to be. They're going to unveil that tomorrow. So if nothing else, what the Department of Education wants to do is, maybe for the first time in a more aggressive form, is oversee exactly what's going on in those charter schools, look at admissions policies. There are places in this country that are literally getting away with very clear violations of, I mean, schools that really don't represent their communities, schools that are denying special ed services, that are not doing the right thing for bilingual or limited English proficient kids. So the department, I guess, is saying give us some time.
To be continued. So I hope you all will come back and talk again about this very important issue. Claudio Sanchez is NPR's education correspondent. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studio, along with Wade Henderson, the president of the Leadership Conference Education Fund, an organization that promotes civil and human rights. Also with us, Bill Perkins. He's a Democratic state senator in New York whose districts include Harlem, Washington Heights, and the Upper West Side, and he joined us from his office in Albany, the state capital. I thank you all so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Now, in talking about these big issues of national education policy, it can be easy to overlook the hard work of individual teachers. Back in 1974, math teacher Jaime Escalante arrived at James A. Garfield Senior High School in East Los Angeles, which had all the usual markers of a troubled urban school: high dropout rates, low achievement. Escalante began teaching calculus and was so successful that Garfield High became one of the public schools with the highest number of students enrolled in advanced placement calculus. Now, if all this sounds vaguely familiar, then it's probably because you remember the 1988 film Stand and Deliver, starring Edward James Olmos in the lead role. Today, Jaime Escalante is far away from the classrooms of Garfield High. He's very ill and battling cancer at a treatment center in Reno, Nevada. Los Angeles Times staff reporter Esmeralda Bermudez recently visited him, and she's with us now at NPR from NPR West to tell us about it. Esmeralda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
I just want to play a short clip from the film just so that people remember who it is that we're talking about. And here it is. And this is from a clip in which Jaime Escalante is responding to a belligerent student who gave him the, well, what we'll call the one-fingered salute. Let's call it that. Here it is.
Mm-hmm. Really? Come on, a negative 2 plus 2 equals. Anybody can do it. Fill the hole. Minus 2 plus 2 equals. Come on, just fill the hole. You can do it. You're gonna let these burros laugh at you. Minus 2 plus 2 equals. I'll break your neck like a toothpick. Morale.
Zero.
Zero? You're right.
Simple. That's it. Minus 2 plus 2 equals zero. He just filled the hole. Did you know that neither the Greeks nor the Romans were capable of using the concept of zero? It was your ancestors, the Mayas, who first contemplated the zero, the absence of value. True story. You burros have math in your blood.
So, Esmeralda, you found out that I think a lot of people still remember Jaime Escalante and still remember that film. But you're saying back at the high school at Garfield, there's very little trace of him. You say his name is rarely mentioned. There's really no recognition of him. Why is that?
You know, it's sort of a mystery. I talked to the assistant principal, one of the assistant principals, at length about this, and he was there. He actually, I think he graduated, I want to say maybe in the 80s or so. So he was there when Jaime Escalante was there. He was aware of his reputation. But as I mentioned in the story, when Mr. Escalante left the school, it was there was a lot of discord. There was a lot of, he says, a lot of jealousy, a lot of politics that he didn't want to get involved with. And a lot of the teachers apparently were resentful of the fact that he had his own copy machine. From what I understand, at some point he had his own secretary. He was getting lots of funding from different companies. And it seems from what the assistant principal told me that it's possible that some of that resentment still lingers till this day. There are a few of his students who teach there, and not very many were really, you know, willing or eager to talk about him.
Why not? Why do you think that is?
One of the things that the assistant principal mentioned to me over and over was, we're moving on. We have other things to focus on at this point. We're really busy with other things. We can't. The movie only lasted so long, was something he mentioned to me. And you can't keep this battle cry going and going. Eventually, students are going to get fed up with it. And he just... His name, you don't... If you walk around through the campus, you're really not going to see anything. And his classroom... It's a nondescript building. If it weren't for the sign that says his name and the word Ganas, which was his rallying cry to students, you wouldn't notice it.
Hmm. Well, you also mentioned that he is very ill. When you visited with him, you said he doesn't have much time left.
Right. Just a few weeks ago, he had been living in Bolivia for a number of years, and he came to Northern California about 6 months ago to receive care. And just a few weeks ago, he was told by doctors that he just has a few months at best to live. And he was sent home to his family, and they basically were told to just wait for him to die.
That's sad. Mm-hmm. You said in retrospect he wishes he had never left Garfield High. Why did he leave, and why does he now say he wishes he hadn't?
This is something one of his best friends told me, Angelo Villavicencio, who was there visiting Mr. Escalante when I was in Reno. And, you know, it's funny. It's been so many years, but and he can't speak. His vocal cords have been burned from stomach acids from his various illnesses. And while I was there, this man struggled so hard to just convey that same message that he was conveying at Garfield. He wanted to continue that. And I think it still lives with him very vividly till this day. That was his
legacy.
Exactly, sure. His biggest accomplishment.
Well, that's sad. Well, thank you for keeping us up to date on it, even though it is a sad story. Esmeralda Bermudez was kind enough to join us from our studios at NPR West. She's a staff reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Esmeralda, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And now we turn to our money coach, Alvin Hall, our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. The Obama administration continues to fight the ongoing foreclosure crisis. Their first set of initiatives have not been particularly successful. Now, instead of trying to keep homeowners in their homes, they are considering a new approach that compensates them if they leave. Here to tell us more about that is Alvin Hall. He's with us from New York. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here to talk about this subject.
So what's the point of this?
The idea is that there are more than 5 million households that are behind in their mortgages and are risking foreclosure. And this really threatens the economic recovery. So rather than having these people just move out and give their houses back to the bank and have some of them ransacked by people in the neighborhood, they've decided to take a more moderate approach to encourage people to sell their houses for less than they are worth.
And that's called a short sale.
That's called a short sale, where your house, you have an outstanding loan that is way in excess of the value of your house. Under this program, which is called the House Affordable Foreclosure Alternative, you get to sell your house for whatever the market price is, and then the difference between what you owe and the sale price is forgiven by the lender.
And why would a homeowner want to do that? And I should mention that this program is supposed to start on April 5th. So why would a homeowner choose to do this?
A homeowner would choose to do this because of the impact on their credit. One, the typically, people say that this only hits your credit rating or reduces your credit score by anywhere from 50 to 150 points, as opposed to a foreclosure where your credit score may drop 200 to 400 points. Also, if you go through this plan, then if you've never been in arrears on your mortgage and you do a short sale, then you can go out and almost immediately be eligible to buy another house. If, however, you've fallen in arrears on your loan and you then want to buy a new house, and after a short sale, it would take 24 months to do it. So you can still get into the market. Whereas with a foreclosure, it sits on your record for 5 to 7 years, and that will have a huge impact on your ability to get other credit.
So does the administration think that many people will take advantage of this? As you just mentioned that over 5 million homeowners are at risk for foreclosure now.
Yes. I think they're hoping people will. It's a really complicated plan that looks a lot like their home modification plan. For example, if you can get a bank who is willing to do this, then the bank that helps you arrange the short sale will receive $1,000. In the case, if you have a second mortgage and that bank is willing to participate in this, they will get $1,000. And then the people who have the loan, who have the property, excuse me, will then get a relocation loan of $1,500. So I think the government is hoping that with all of these incentives, it will spur both the banks and the individuals holding the mortgages to come down, sit at the table, and come up with an alternative.
So the idea is to move people out of houses that have lost value or houses that they can no longer afford and move them into other housing, basically to get some movement in the market. But why wouldn't you just buy back your same house?
Ooh, wouldn't that be interesting? For one thing, the government wouldn't allow you to do that because basically the lender is saying, what is this? You're buying back your house. This is a manipulation of the market. This is fraud. So you literally have to leave that property and go to another one. Also, Michelle,
But why? The whole point is to manipulate the market, isn't it? The point is to get people out of houses that they can no longer afford that have lost value.
You know, that would make... I would agree with you at one level. It would make sense to do that. But I think if the bank has agreed to let you walk away from this property and reduce the amount of your loan through a short sale, then someone else had to buy the property. It could be a relative of yours, could be somebody that you know, I'm sure, and you could then rent from them. But you yourself would be prohibited from buying the property because that would be viewed as fraud. And you have to admit that if somebody did that, the banks and all the financing institutions would turn and say, look at this, this is a scam, right? We're not going to participate in this. And the knock-on effect for other people trying to do the right thing would be huge. And it would basically bring a failure to the program.
How does it start? Just give me the basic in the minute that we have left. What does a homeowner need to do? Does the homeowner need to find a buyer, or does the homeowner to participate in this simply need to put his or her house on the market and recognize that this program exists after April 5th when it's supposed to start?
You need to put your house on the market, find an agent who's willing to do a short sale, negotiate with the bank so the bank will know that that's what's going on, and make sure they accept the terms of the short sale. Under the program, there has to be an independent valuation of the house so that you're selling it at the market value. If you get that price or more, then the lender is required to accept that price and at the same time forgive you of the loan. It is very similar to a regular house sale, which is why I think it's much more comfortable to people. Whereas a foreclosure, you're opening yourself up to the courts, the decisions, the banks, and their inability to negotiate, and it becomes very difficult. And it's unknown territory for most people.
Well, this is interesting, Alvin. So keep us posted on this, if you will.
Thank you. I will.
All right. Alvin Hall is Tell Me More's regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy, our money coach, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. Thanks, Alvin.
Enjoyed this.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, our moms talk about that Delaware pediatrician who is accused of abusing more than 100 kids who had been under his care. We'll talk about the kinds of things parents can do to protect their children. Our conversation will include pediatrician Dr. Marilyn Corder. That's just ahead. But we begin on a happier note. Last night's historic win for the University of Connecticut women's basketball team, the Huskies. The Huskies shattered their own record for most consecutive wins in women's college basketball last night. They won their 71st game, all of them by more than 10 points. They soundly defeated Notre Dame by a final score of 59-44, and this was after one of their players, sophomore Caroline Doty, took a fall just a minute before the end of the game.
UConn 1 minute away from 71 straight wins. Doty took a hit and went down. Geno is livid that there was no
Geno being head coach Geno Auriemma, here to talk more about this historic victory and how the Huskies have come to dominate women's basketball is Tondalea Wilder, who follows women's sports from Miami. Her radio production and PR company is called She Got Game, and she's with us now. Hi there. Blood pressure back down?
Oh, barely.
You know, that Notre Dame was within 10 points of UConn with less than 4 minutes to go. Now, a margin like that almost qualifies as a win when playing against the Huskies. So how did the Huskies pull it off?
Well, you know what? This is a team that knows how to win. I mean, and they're used to winning. The Huskies are the Goliaths of women's college basketball right now. I mean, if you look at them, they're big, intimidating, unbeaten. I think they actually psych most teams out before they even hit the court. And, you know, as we heard, they've got excellent leadership in Coach Geno Auriemma. They've got the two best players in the nation, Maya Moore, who's an explosive dunker, and Tina Charles, a virtual scoring machine, and a supporting cast that, frankly, Michelle, would have most college coaches in the league salivating.
Well, why is that, though? What explains this dominance year after year? Is it aggressive recruitment? Is it what is it?
It is. It's all of that. And, you know, the top players want to play for Geno Auriemma. You know, the team is very disciplined. You know, they just have an incredible record. They're a dynasty within themselves. And, you know, who wouldn't want to be there? Who wouldn't want to play college basketball on that level? And frankly, you could take that entire team right now and they could probably be a WNBA team. That's how good they are.
And as I understand it, though, that they're focusing more on the Big East championship game tonight against ninth-ranked West Virginia. At least that's what they say.
Yeah.
They say that they're more focused on tonight's game than they are about on
no,
the street. Do you believe
they
that?
Are. Yeah, that's what makes UConn so great, because they're so disciplined. They're like that. They're very tunnel vision in their focus. They don't go and celebrate after these victories. You know, they celebrate in the locker room and that kind of thing. But Coach Auriemma has them very, very focused, and it's all about winning the big thing, you know, winning the championship, winning the Big East tournament. It's not just necessarily about the streaks. It's great to have, but that's how they end up being so unbeatable.
Do you think that they are setting a standard for women's basketball, or just people just assume it's sui generis? I guess I think I'm more interested in the question of whether this kind of thing brings more respect to the women's game.
Well, you know, it's kind of debatable, because some people say UConn's dominance is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, to see one team do so well and roll over opponents, you know, night after night, game after game, it's fun to watch, and it's good for the game because people want to see just how good they really are. On the other hand, when one team takes over like this, it makes you wonder about the overall quality of play within the league. You know, do these other teams really need to raise the level of their game? And do we really want to see one team crushing opponents after opponent every time with double-digit wins? I say No streak lasts forever. UConn's dominance right now is good. They've raised the bar, and other teams have to figure out what they need to do to beat them. Better recruiting, more analysis, be more hungry, whatever. And I don't see it any different than Tiger Woods' dominance on the golf course or the Yankees' dominance in baseball. But I do think, Michelle, what would make this more entertaining is a major rivalry. And at one time, we did have that with Tennessee. And if you remember, Tennessee in the past, under the tutelage of the great Pat Summitt, went undefeated as well.
Sure. And finally, in the minute and a half we have left, I did want to ask you about another sort of controversy in women's basketball, and that's that famous punch thrown last week by a player at Baylor when Baylor was playing Texas Tech. And the player in that case was suspended, not just for one game, which is standard, but for two by her own coach. I wanted to ask you about that incident. I mean, a lot of people have sparked some discussion about whether, you know, the women are now acting like the guys and sort of bringing this level of intensity to the court. People are saying, well, why wouldn't you expect that in a hard-fought game? What's your take on this?
Well, I think it's much ado about nothing. I mean, I think it's an isolated incident. You know, there's no question about it. The league is a lot more competitive now. You know, the stakes are higher, you know, but, you know, for the most part, it's been a great positive league, and the women have conducted themselves in a positive manner. So, you know, I think it's an isolated incident.
You think it's gotten too much attention, not enough attention, should get more attention?
You know,
it's front page news,
you know,
and sports pages,
yeah,
which women's basketball rarely is.
Right, exactly. So there's that draw because now more people are interested, you know, but in not a good way. So I just, again, I think it's much ado about nothing. I think we need to focus on things like this: UConn's dominance, 70 straight wins, and, you know, people raising the bar, you know, and watching these great, talented women do what they do. They got game.
Yes, ma'am. I heard the scolding there. I heard the scolding. I hear you. Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me.
Just asking. Donna Leah Wilder heads She Got Game, a Miami-based PR and radio production company, and she joined us from Miami. Donna Leah, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Finally today, we want to talk about what has to be one of a parent's worst nightmares. And I know that that's one of those cliches invoked so often you want to tune it out, but in this case, it has to be true. Finding out that your child has become a victim of sexual abuse. To make matters worse, the predator is not some stranger, but the one person most people rely upon to keep their children healthy, the pediatrician. A Delaware grand jury recently indicted Dr. Earl Bradley, a pediatrician, on over 400 felony counts in the alleged sexual abuse of his young patients, ranging in age from 18 months to 14 years. He is charged with sexually assaulting 102 girls and one boy that he treated. Some of the abuses were caught on more than a dozen hours of videotape seized from the doctor's office and home. Dr. Bradley's being held on bail. His license has been permanently revoked. Now, of course, Bradley has not been found guilty, and he has a right to a fair trial. But in light of these horrific allegations, we wanted to take a minute to think about the lessons for parents and caregivers. Here to help us answer this are Dr. Marilyn Corder. She's a pediatrician with a diverse practice in Washington, D.C. She's also an associate professor of pediatrics, and two of our regular contributors to our weekly Moms Conversations, Jolene Ivey and Leslie Morgensteiner. Welcome, ladies, moms. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Dr. Corder, it's been reported that this has gone on for years. And I think a lot of people would like to know, how is it possible that even a trusted figure like a pediatrician could allegedly abuse this many patients over the course of such a long time without being detected?
Absolutely. Now the reports are saying it's over two decades. And apparently there had been complaints alleged against him, but unfortunately they just kind of dismissed it or said, you know, they didn't have enough proof. And authorities and hospitals just kind of moved him on. And as he went from place to place, the right thing would have been to have reported it.
When you heard about this, you know, oftentimes when it's a member of a group, like if it's a member of a group that you belong to, you feel an extra special disgust at something like this.
Gut-wrenching.
You know, what your reaction was.
Gut-wrenching. I was just appalled. I'm a pediatrician of 30 years, and it just hit me because we are supposed to protect.
I want to bring the other moms in. Jolene, what did this case bring up for you? Well, as a mother of five boys,
Yeah, five boys for sure. And we've had two pediatricians over the years pretty much who we just love. And just the thought that they would ever do anything like that is just unthinkable. At the same time, I've been present for most of their exams until they get to a certain age where I think that, you know, I think they need their own privacy with the doctor. And maybe I start thinking now, is that wrong? Should I not let my 14-year-old go in to talk to the doctor? But
let's ask Dr. Korda that question. I think Jolene raises an important point. There is a point at which kids of whatever gender start to want to have private conversations, and the doctor sometimes wants private conversations with the patient. At what point should the parents step out?
There is something called adolescent confidentiality, and as an adolescent specialist, we educate the parents as we raise them in the practice from toddler on up, and we say there's a part of the exam we excuse the parents out, and we make sure it's okay with the child, the teenager, because that will allow the patient feel comfortable in talking about adolescent issues, sexuality, drugs, just risky or, you know, just what's going on with them. But you still include the parents even afterwards. You just say, okay, all is well, or, you know, you still have some involvement, but you want to make sure that that communication with the doctor, with the patient, is above board.
Apparently some of this alleged abuse occurred when the doctor would allow a child to take a toy, for example, a toy box, which a number of medical professionals have as an incentive for a child to come. And apparently they'll say that this happened in a matter of minutes. He would take the child, say, to a basement. And that's, in fact, where this behavior was initially discovered, was when a two-year-old told her mother that Dr. Bradley allegedly hurt her in December of 2009 when he took her to a basement room of his office after an exam. And the parent in that case says that the child was only out of his or her presence for a matter of minutes. So what does that tell us, though, that you shouldn't let your child out of your sight at all? Leslie, what do you think?
You know, as an abuse victim myself, I was a victim of spousal abuse, not childhood sexual abuse. The first thing that occurred to me is that abuse thrives only in silence. And I think this little girl, the two-year-old, who told her parents and her parents for listening to her are heroes in a way because they broke the silence. And I think it's very easy to dismiss a two-year-old, especially when they come to you and say, the doctor hurt me, because going to the doctor isn't pleasant. Some of it does hurt. And it would have been really easy for the parents to just say, no, you're imagining it. But they listened and raised an alarm. And to me, that's the hope of this, is that more parents will listen to their kids and more kids will speak out.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit with the moms, and we're talking with Dr. Marilyn Korda, a pediatrician, Jolene Ivey and Leslie Morgensteiner. And we're talking about the Delaware pediatrician who is accused of sexually abusing over 100 of his young patients. And we're talking about what we can learn from this. Jolene, when you talk about, can you give us exactly what language to use with different ages of kids to make sure that they can talk to you about something like this?
Well, what I've said to my boys from the time they were very little is, you know, as you're giving them a bath, you might talk about, oh, this is your penis or these are your testicles or whatever, so that they're comfortable with the words and that it's nothing to be embarrassed about. And then when you start talking about, well, these parts of your body are private. These are parts that, you know, I might help you wash right now, but when you get older, even I won't help you with. And the only people who can touch these parts are the ones you give permission to. So no one gets permission without you giving it to them, whether it's an adult or another kid or whoever it is, so that they feel ownership over their bodies.
Mm. Leslie, what about you?
I've done what Jolene has done with my three kids, but I took it even a step further, that I explained to them that there are some people who intentionally try to have sex with kids. And I know it's a shocking thing to talk about with your children, but I felt like I had to be really explicit. So I was very intentionally specific, and I told them that they needed to tell me if that ever happened.
Dr. Korda, there are things about going to the doctor that do hurt.
Yes.
I mean, one of the hardest things for me when I had children was holding my kids down to get shots. It used to kill me. It took every ounce of my strength to hold my children down to get them immunized. So then to turn around and say, it's not supposed to hurt, help us out here.
Okay. You know, coming to the doctor's office sometimes is traumatic. When you know your child's going to get a shot, the two-year-old will start to cry. We say it's an immunization. We explain it to them. They begin to understand it's just for a quick shot to make sure bad germs don't attack you. But there's a certain conversation that we have with the parents as we're talking to the child about the no-no touch. about this is not appropriate. And I have to encourage my medical students, my residents, when they're examining, you get permission and you exercise that each visit. Mommy, I'm about to examine Jamal or Jessica, and let Jamal and Jessica know it's okay. This is only when mommy is in the room or daddy's in the room or grandma's in the room, and that must be protected.
Leslie?
I think that, you know, this is just another example of why you need to talk to your kids about sex, and that it's never too young to talk to them openly about sex. I also think that in addition to talking, you have to listen really carefully to your kids. And if there's anything that they say that indicates that anybody has made them uncomfortable, listen to them. And listening also means listen to their bodies. One of my best friends from college is a pediatrician, and she used to say to my kids, you know, it's your body, you get to decide. And I've used that, even when we lived in Minnesota, I'd never forced my kids to wear a winter coat because I would say, it's your body. And I think that that's sort of part of listening to a kid is when they say they don't want to do something, I think there are times, you know, obviously there are times where you have to impose your will, but you've got to be really careful and listen when they're giving you clues about things that are going on and teach them to listen to their own instincts.
Let's say I take what you had to say, but I think you can't help but second guess and think of all the times that you let your child go down the hallway without you or something, and you're playing it in your mind thinking, what could I have done?
Exactly. You know, in my pediatrician's office, they take kids into a small dark room for the eye exam, and they don't let parents in because it's a tiny room, and my kids are never going in that room again alone. You know, I think that obviously we can learn, but it's different to learn something versus beating yourself up for something that's really, truly not your fault. That just gets in the way of helping your kids in the future.
Jillian, final thought?
Well, no one wants their kid or any kid to be the canary in the coal mine. You don't want any kid to have to experience sexual abuse at all. So the more adults can do to look out around them, to be aware, people, friends, family, whoever, if somebody's giving you the creeps, there might be a reason for it. So listen to yourself, listen to your kids, and don't beat yourself up, but be aware.
Dr. Corder, final thought from you?
Yes, and this is something that we're seeing increasingly in our community to the point that, you know, we used to have our children able to go to the playgrounds and go out, but keep an eye on your children and make sure that you read their body language as well as how their discomfort around some individuals. And pop in on the daycare. This is just not the pediatrician. Just go on scheduled appearances, different places that you allow your children to spend hours. So it's very important to listen and to educate.
Dr. Marilyn Corder is a pediatrician with a practice in Washington, D.C. She's also an associate professor of pediatrics at two different institutions of higher learning here in the Washington, D.C. area. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio along with Jolene Ivey and Leslie Morgensteiner, our regular Tell Me More Parenting contributors. And I thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.